Welcome to the Scottish Watches podcast. We have got a special guest, and depending on the timing, maybe our episode will be out in Fratello's podcast before this is out, or this will be out before them. I'm not 100% sure. But Dave, why don't you introduce who we have on the line today?
We have RG. Oh, no, it's not RG. It's the other one.
No, it's the other one.
It's the gimp.
It's the one that does
it's not
all
the organ
work.
Grinder. It's the monkey.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd sooner be front and centre of everyone's attention. Who wants to be the organ grinder? No, I am the monkey. Yeah, I'm actually the second RJ. We're both RJ. And in my private life, I'm known as RJ. But at work, I'm just Rob. So hi.
Just Rob Nudds. So we have Mr. Rob Nudds, who does all the hard work behind the scenes. Is that what we're going to stick with, Rob?
Yeah.
If you say so. It's not too hard. It's all a pleasure, you know, and it's certainly a pleasure to get to talk to you two right now. And thank you for accommodating my availability. It was very nice of you to make this effort.
Well, I mean, you've turned up on a very warm, sweaty day in a faraway place. You've turned off your AC. You've closed the window. You're wearing a wife beater. You know, it's all good.
Well, you know, I'd like that to be more exceptional for you guys than it actually is, but that's pretty much par for the course for me. But yes, I am profusely sweating. It is close to 40 degrees in my oven of an office, and I'm wearing a late 90s, early 2000s New York Knicks jersey, I'll have you know. And I have never beaten anyone's wife, much less my own.
Just the bishop.
Just the bishop. Oh yeah, on regular occasion.
We'll all concur on that matter. Anyone that says otherwise is a liar.
Absolutely. Yes.
You know what you've tuned in for when you're on the Scottish Watches podcast, but welcome to the show. We obviously managed to appear on your show, which, as I say, should be out just now or will be out very soon. And we thought we'd return the favour because, as I mentioned to you before, I didn't know what to expect having a chat with you the first time because we've only spoken maybe once or twice in the past. And we had such a good laugh. I thought, you know what, let's continue this conversation on because that 1 hour that we all had together just wasn't enough. So welcome to Scotland.
Thank you very much. I can't wait to be back in Scotland for real. It's one of my favourite places in the whole world. And for anyone that wants to listen to part one of this chat, yes, it should be live on Fratello already. Fratello on air, episode 105. So we're quite some way behind you guys in the podcast game. And it would have come out yesterday at 2 p.m. So go find that on all your regular podcast sources. And this is the bigger, badder, better sequel, right? We come back to your neck of the woods and all the restrictions are off. We can say what we like now.
I did say this is the place where you can feel at ease. This is a speakeasy. You can say what you like. Don't worry about it. And we won't tell RJ all the nasty things that you said about him before we hit record either.
He never listens to any of my content anyway. He never bothers tuning in. So there's no danger of that. And you said this was an outlet for my professional frustrations. Well, I've got 20 years of them. So I hope you've got a lot of time.
Well, we should probably do that wrist check thing that people seem to like. And before Mizio gives us a hard time, and you're the guest of honour today, so you can hit us with what you're wearing, and it's probably nothing.
I actually have got something on. I mean, I keep taking it on and putting it back off because it is absolutely sweltering, but I'm wearing the Lavender Sumerine, which is probably going to get me a load of heat this week, additional heat to the 40 degrees I'm suffering right now because of the recent release of the Chronograph that I think I mentioned in passing to you the other day. And the brand has come under quite a lot of fire for the release strategy, or maybe fairer to the people behind or the person behind the brand is maybe the lack of release strategy that has been frustrating some would-be buyers over the last week. But I'm sticking to the fact that the brand makes amazing watches, and I've got two of the four they've previously released, and I will have one of the newer ones myself in due course. And so I've got the bronze cased black dialed Lavender Sumerine dive watch.
Did I read something on Fratello about these guys and in-house movements and stuff?
Not in-house. Let's not go down the Bremont route and f*** that one up right off the bat. It's proprietary and, you know, pretty basic proprietary, to be honest, but it's a gorgeous looking thing. It's got a Gyromax balance and some really tasty green bridges with a gold rotor weight. Now, that's just a base module. It's time only, and they've stuck a Dubois Dupré chronograph module on top of it. So what that means is we're likely to see this new proprietary time-only caliber feature in many, many watches from Lavender in the future with different complications grafted onto the dial side.
And what's the history of this brand? It's one I'm not familiar with.
Well, it's a short history. It started in 2017, launched on Kickstarter by a industrial designer called Clement Goad. He'd worked in watchmaking for a few years as a watch designer, but he'd also worked in car design and yacht design, and I don't think he ever dabbled in architecture, but product design especially. So he had a pretty good, if not particularly long-lived pedigree. He'd worked for some pretty big names. I mean, Audemars Piguet stuck out in my mind. I can't remember the list of everyone else on there, but there was quite a few names. He'd bounced around a bit and lent his hand to many fine things, and he wanted to start his own little project, so he did, and he launched with what we could quite fairly say was a Nautilus-inspired adventure watch, robust and Very handsome, wearable, everyday watch, 40.5mm case. In the early days, there were pretty basic movements inside him, ETAs and Sellitas. And he's only just stepped that up with this proprietary caliber, but he's been improving the product line with every release, adding functionality or improving the aesthetics of the finishing. His third release, the Transatlantique GMT, had this plexiglass bezel that recalled the early Bakelite bezels of GMT Master, and it was absolutely heavenly. It was the first one I didn't buy, actually, and it's my biggest watchmaking regret. But interestingly enough, right, this latest drop that came out last week on the 21st, so just over a week ago now, he released 99 pieces of this chronograph, modular proprietary movement, and they were gone in seconds. And there was a lot of disgruntlement amongst the community, which has grown exponentially since the brand first launched. And many people were frustrated, not just at the fact there are only 99 pieces to begin with, but the way in which so many of them seem to have been sold before the launch date. Now, I know for a fact that 24 hours before he launched to the public, he did send out a pre-order email to existing customers, of which I was one, and that's how I got mine, ahead of the crowd. He didn't sell all the pieces, despite what's been said in the comments. And for a while, I tried to sort of not really like explain the situation, because I didn't want to pull back somebody else's curtain, but I tried to offer alternative explanations for what seemed like a very suspicious few seconds of launch time. And one of them was quite simply this: the system he uses in his shop means that as soon as an item goes into the cart, it's held for a certain period of time. You know, if you buy tickets on Ticketmaster, you get them for like 10 or 12 minutes or something. Same with train line tickets or something, they guarantee them for a while. Now, from what I understand, and I don't understand this very deeply, it's not my area of specialization, but I think it's quite rare these days to use that format. I think more likely you would have stock levels adjusted as you go through the payment phase specifically, and stuff can disappear from your cart in that process. So I think everyone's assuming that he's using that kind of system, but I said to him, look, either you've miscommunicated this or something else is going on, like you've launched half the models or a third of the models and they've all gone into carts within 5 seconds, which is totally possible, of course. If you've got 5,000 people on your website trying to buy the same watch, of course it's possible. And then the last one is checked out 7 minutes later, which is, you know, caused him to put out an IG post saying sold out in 7 minutes. So that's annoyed a large swath of the community that was on the website 15 seconds after it launched and the watch was showing sold out because they're all in a basket. Now, what we need here, all we can take away from it is just like lessons in transparency and how to communicate to your audience and to make sure they know exactly what's available and when and what chance they've got of getting it. Of course, it doesn't make any actual difference to their chances of getting it. If there's 15 pieces available or 50 pieces available or 500 pieces available, it is what it is. But it helps with people's expectations, I believe. At least that's what I've been able to glean from reading the comments. So I got into it in 2017. I flukily backed the very first one. I bought the follow-up. I passed on the third and fourth, regrettably. Stepped back in for the fifth one. And in that period of time, I've watched it go from a brand that I had to defend tooth and nail for being streets ahead of other micro brands in terms of build quality. And I knew this for a fact because I've been to the factory where they make their cases, and they make stuff like from brands that sell frequently for six figures in the same case department. And it's expertise that transfers sideways, you know, like it goes up and down the chain. So these guys are benefiting from that kind of quality. They're not having these cases shipped in from China or whatnot. So it's gone from this brand that I was defending like this for years and years and years to maybe having a very brief window of universal adoration and genuine enthusiast cool around the third release, to now sort of accidentally transitioning to something of a hype brand. So I don't think that Clermont could really have predicted this kind of success, or whether he even coveted this particular kind of success. But obviously it feeds into everybody's angst surrounding artificial scarcity and this deliberate exclusionary tactic performed by certain brands who shall remain nameless on a much larger scale, and emulated maybe by smaller brands like this. But that's what I'm wearing. I'll shut up now.
I like it when we get someone on the show that's eloquent, well-spoken, knows what they're talking about, has a deep history with a brand they're speaking about, and can speak from behind the curtain. Well done, Rob. You can come back more often.
That was a masterclass.
Mwah. Chef's kiss.
That's 5 minutes extra we don't need to record, so that's perfect. Well done. Thank you so much.
Waiting for the punchline to that, but you're welcome. Thank you for listening to me. I appreciate it.
See, that's the difficulty you're going to have. It's telling if we're being sarcastic or genuine. But actually, that time, we were being a little bit genuine.
Jesus.
It won't happen again. Don't worry, listeners.
A lot of sarcasm with a touch of genuine on that one. But no, I think you're right. You brought up a few interesting points there. There's been a lot of brands that you could kind of have analogies with there as well.
Ming! Oh, fuck!
Yeah, I think it's fair to say Ming were in that category as well. You know, initially, no one paid too much attention. Then they got kind of really cool. Then the hype train hit. And exactly the same complaints leveled at them. You're artificially creating hype.
You're trying to say all those people that queued up online to try and buy one of those Messina Lab Ming watches at 75 minutes past one in the afternoon, you know, they never really got into the queue.
That's a whole different level of hype. That collab is a whole different level of hype. But yeah, I mean... Mm-hmm. I think you make a lot of fair points, but let's be honest, there's an awful lot of buying public who rationale goes out the window when they don't get what they want. I think it's fair to say, you know, too many of them are too used to getting what they want when they want.
Entitlement.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, ultimately it's up to a brand to set their e-commerce platform up how they feel is best suited for them. You know, they don't need to necessarily tailor that to what everyone else wants it to be. And he's obviously using a platform for whatever reason he uses it. So anyway, moving along. Ricky, do you want to go second?
Right, okay, I'll go second. So today I'm wearing a watch that's been in a watch box for nearly 2 years. Don't wear it often enough, but I'm wearing it today because it's a sunny day and the dial on this one just glints and gleams away when we get hit with those ultraviolet rays. It is, of course, the Oris Aquis, the big boy, but it's the Hangang Edition, limited edition, came out a couple of years ago, and it is my first and only Oris. My first green watch, and I should wear it more often, but I do not. So I'm going to try and rectify that situation over summer if we get a good one here in Scotland. Over to you, Dave.
Well, on the theme of green dials, I am with you on that. I am wearing my Moser Streamliner Center Seconds in green, which is quite possibly my favourite watch. I'm just going to say it now. It is my favourite watch. I've got lots of watches that I really love, but this is the go-to favourite piece. It's just the right size. It's just the right colour. It's just the right shape. Everything about it is pretty much perfect in my book. So don't need to say any more, really.
Calling back to what Rob said about his wrist check there and the hassle some brands get. I mean, I remember the shit fest that ended up at Max Busser's door when he released the Red One just a couple of months ago there. And because people hadn't got in touch with him a year ago, which I'd asked if I could get the blue one. You know, he was a decent enough guy that he kept his word. He'd said, oh, well, you know, if we do something in the future, I'll keep your details on file. You know what it's like when you apply for a job? Thank you for your interest. We will keep your CV and details on file. Well, he actually did. But everybody went fucking mental at him and gave him a whole load of shit because they didn't get something that they thought they were entitled to just because they had money burning a hole in their pocket.
That's the funny one. You know, I've got one of those. Mad one red.
Oh, have you? Dave, have you got one? Dave, have you only got... Oh, he's got a finger.
He's got a single finger waving in the camera there because he didn't ask for one.
But he's got a Moser, you know, so we're allowed to take a piss out of him.
Yeah, we can do this.
I mean, it's a child's Moser. It's a flick-back Moser. It fits his little wrist.
Yakety-yak. The mad one, I really like it and... I don't know why. As we've talked about this before, Ricky, I should love that watch. It should be right up my street. I like something a little bit left field. And I don't quite know what it is about it. I don't dislike it in any way, but I don't actually have any feeling of, oh, I must have that watch. I guess it's just maybe where I'm at with a collection. If anything, I need to pare my collection back a bit and not kind of jump into the, oh, there's another watch at £2,000 or £3,000 or £4,000 that I can, you know, make efforts to get if I wanted to. But I love it. And every time I see yours, I think that's such a cool watch. I would wear it quite happily, but I don't feel the need to actually have that watch.
I kind of thought the same thing when I first saw the blue one, that's for sure. But then I ran into that one in real life on the wrist of James Thompson, the Black Badger.
Shout out to James.
We love James. Hi, James. How are
James.
You? Actually, you know what? James might be in Canada right now.
He is in Canada.
Is he not? He sent me a picture with the guys that made the Viscount looking watch. It looks like the old Viscount wrappers.
The GOS, you mean? The one GOS. With the
Goss.
The loom. Yeah. Yeah, well, he's about to go to Canada if he's not there already for the first time in like 2.5, 3 years or something to see his family.
See the family, yeah.
Enjoy it, James. It'll be nice for you, I'm sure.
Oh, you can catch up in all those missed episodes of Terence and Philip.
I'm sure it does burn a deep hole in his soul, actually, to be honest. But what he doesn't have to worry about catching up on is wrist time with the Mad One, because he's got one. And as soon as I saw his, wanted one. So I did write a speculative, and I felt at the time kind of cheeky letter to, not directly to Max, to Charis. And I said, oh, you know, if you ever make one of these, could maybe little Bobby Nuds have one as well? And again, I got the sort of like response that I thought was just, you know, a polite way to fob you off and say, yeah, no, get out of my yard, you little weirdo. But as it turned out, they were legit. And the minute that it came out, I sort of emailed Charis again thinking, do you remember that I asked for one of these? He said, yeah, sure, you can come pick it up next Friday from the boutique in Geneva. I was like, okay, great. I'll go. And I got it and I wore it immediately. Obviously, I took my chapek off and put it back in the Mad One box, and I put the Mad One on, and I went out. And obviously at Watches and Wonders, if you had one of those on your wrist, people were going to stop you and look at it. And I never got so much attention for wearing a watch as I did for that one. And it's a majestic little toy, I guess.
Curiosity.
Yeah, a curiosity. Right. But I guess I kind of know where Dave's coming from here, because the longer I've had it, the less inclined I am to wear it as a watch. I mean, I can't tell the time on it for shit. I'm sure some people can. And I understand how it works and I should be able to do it, but I keep making a mistake. I'm looking at it in the wrong way. I don't know. It's just the way my brain doesn't work.
You're looking at the number closest to the indicator. So if it means it's after the half past of the hour, you think it's
right
the other hour.
That's definitely what happens to me. Yeah, I'm always like 1 hour out. I mean, the minutes are fine, but the hour always messes with me for some reason. So I've stopped like wearing it around, and it is quite a tall and unwieldy thing. And, you know, you don't want to catch it on a doorframe and smash it to high heaven. But I do get it out of the box and I look at it and I show it to people quite a lot and say, oh, look at this curiosity. Isn't it nice? But how long I will keep it in my collection, I don't know. I mean, I'm certainly not going to sell it anytime soon, because that would be a real slight to the generosity shown to me by MBNF, and perhaps it'll hang around as that weird curiosity for eternity. But yeah, it isn't going to get the kind of wrist time I'd hoped it would.
That's strange, because I've had the opposite reaction. I bought it. Oh, did I buy it by accident? I suppose, the same as you, we had Max Busser on the show, then the Mad One came out, and we got a hold of him again, and I sent him a direct message. I didn't just, you know, go to the underlings at MBNF. I went straight to the top dog and said, hey, how's it going? Listen, I know this blue and white thing is for friends, but is that friends or is that podcaster friends? And he said, sorry, we don't have any left, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, oh, well. And he says, but if we do something in future, then obviously that's where this came about. But I just jumped on it without thinking. And then when it was coming over and all the rest of it, I even saw Zach Blass from Time and Tide, because as you say, everybody that watches the Wonders who was on the list had one. And I looked at it and I thought, oh, I'm not really that interested. But when it arrived and I put it on, it grew. It was like an addiction, you know, an acquired taste. And I absolutely love wearing it, to the point where I'm actually told off by people for wearing it too much.
Isn't it funny how there's three people here who love watches? All of us agree it's a cool watch. All of us agree it's funky. None of us dislike it. We've got me who's like, yep, I like it. I've seen the blue one in person. I've seen the red one in person. I still think it's cool. I've got no desire to have one or get one or want one. Ricky, who was like, yeah, 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 it's cool, but I don't know if I want one. And it's grown on him. And he now wears it too much, arguably, if he says so himself. And you who got it because you thought it was cool and you would wear it, and you're beginning to wear it less now. It's strange how the same object can be adored, but very differently kind of engaged with.
I mean, that's a fantastic point that applies to so many of the watches in our collections, I guess, how our relationships have gone in much different directions than we ever anticipated they would. And certain watches that maybe start out quite run-of-the-mill, very boring in many lights, and become like those daily go-tos that we rely upon. I read an article by Thor on Fratello today about how he bought the most boring Grand Seiko in the catalogue, which, you know, okay, it's a bit of a clickbaity title. Yeah, right. But you know what? That's a fair point, because Grand Seiko on screen, especially thanks to the terrible product photography, and I've said this to their face, so I can say it to you on here right now, but it's just, they do not sell themselves at all. And then you get them on the wrist, or you get them in real natural light, and they start coming alive in ways you never anticipated. And Thor did pick a particularly boring one. It had like a sort of slate grey dial, I guess, sort of with a very fine vertical striation. And it just looked like nothing at all. But in certain angles, certain lights, the indices completely blew up and looked like they were floating above the dial. Like the little GS logo looked like it was just polished from pure platinum and like hovering on as like a sapphire disc above the dial. These crazy little tricks of the light in the most boring watch ever. And then you've got something like the Mad One for me, which weirdly enough, it's a very comfortable watch to wear. I don't know if you find that as well, Ricky, but it's surprisingly good on the wrist, however tall it is.
Do you find people say to you when they pick up, they go, oh, that's really light. I was expecting that to be a lot heavier.
Yeah, it is light though. I mean, isn't like half the case sapphire or mineral crystal or something?
Yep, mineral on the bottom, sapphire on the top. The comments, that's a cool fidget spinner. And is that a yo-yo?
It does look like a yo-yo, yeah. It does take me back. But I mean, I love it. But it's on the other end of the spectrum from like a really boring grey-dialed Grand Seiko, which although is like not going to inspire anybody to dash down to a boutique and queue up or email like the CEO of Grand Seiko and ask if they could have one, is the kind of thing that maybe over a long period of time gives you even more pleasure.
Yeah, I think the phrase timeless classic has a grounding, doesn't it? You know, there are some watches that are not the most exciting. They don't jump out and slap you in the face and go, look at me. But you know that you will probably own it for your entire life. And every time you wear it, it's just something special. It's just got that timeless aesthetic to it.
Well, what other watches would you say have had the same effect on you? That maybe you kind of liked it and then you grew out of love, but you didn't want to get rid of it. Or something that has had that bell curve where you loved it, fell out of love, and then came back into it again.
The first one that jumps to my mind that I absolutely adored and moved heaven and earth to get and now rarely wear is WH&T LCF 888 chronograph, which I don't know if you remember it. Does it ring a bell? Ish. Okay, good.
That means Dave doesn't know what you're talking about.
No, I do. I've seen it. I'm thinking.
What is it then, Dave? What's it look like?
A chronograph, funnily enough.
Does it, eh? What colour is it?
I think, did you not have that? I think you might have showed me that one of the very early Red Bar Manchester-y type things.
Yeah, quite possibly. I did used to have it on my wrist quite a lot. I'll tell you why I used to wear it. It's because it looked impressive. That's the God's honest truth. So you go down to a Red Bar meeting and like I've got a lot of, you know, good quality watches, but they're not going to like blow someone's mind, or they're not going to be like something they've never seen a million times already before. So I take the wackier stuff from the smaller brand and say, oh, hey, have you seen this? This is maybe an alternative to whatever. And in the case of the WH&T LCF 888, it's a great alternative to like an Audemars Piguet concept watch, something like a Royal Oak on steroids. Has a little bit of a Hublot sang bleu kind of vibe to it as well. It was actually the result of a school project. So there was this watchmaking school in La Chaux-de-Fonds, and there was a bunch of kids doing their coursework, and some creative lecturer decided that they would give the class universal coursework to produce, design, have manufactured, distribute, advertise everything, a watch, a brand and a watch. And WH&T stands for Wild Horologists and Team, okay? So they also have the best web address ever, because it's what.ch. So when you say it out loud, it is like watch, which is genius. But anyway, these kids designed this watch. It's super derivative. It's like not going to change the world horologically, although it has got a nice proprietary caliber made by Chronode. So like Laventure, strangely enough. And they made 6 variations of this. They were limited to, I don't know how many pieces each, maybe 50, maybe 88, maybe 100, nothing major. And they sold them at cost. So the retail price was supposed to be 4,000 francs or thereabouts. And they were selling the early ones from between 1,500 and 1,800 francs. And this was a proprietary movement chronograph that had all of the crazy out there styling of, no joke, like an Audemars Piguet concept chronograph. And I saw this thing and I was like, what the hell? I was like, this must feel like crap in the hand. There's no way they've done this and they've done it well for that kind of money. So I got my hands on one. I reviewed it. I think I reviewed it for a blog to watch first, and I might have reviewed it for a couple of other places since, but it's amazing. The build quality is absolutely nuts. Like it's just top drawer on every level. Have you ever encountered those gorilla fastbacks?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So you know that beneath the bezel, there's that thin anodized ring of aluminium. Yeah, right. Yep. Now, have you ever scrutinized that, like at the very corners, to see how well the profile aligns with the edge of the case and the bezel itself? Because if you haven't...
Seemed okay.
Yeah, it's okay, but it's not great. In fact, like, it's an exercise in mediocrity, in my opinion. Like, I got it under a microscope and then realized I didn't even need to have the microscope there to see, like, it misses, like, the line that it's supposed to be tracking by quite a bit. There is an aluminium under bezel ring on the WH&T LCF 888, and it is absolutely flawless. And I was thinking to myself, yeah, okay, there is still a massive price difference between the Gorilla and that watch, but that's how you do things properly. And what was really impressive about that project was that they'd made some ambitious design choices, but they'd been clever in the process, and they'd made sure that they could afford to get the best of type, as I always said. So like, sometimes you don't want to go for like the fanciest finish in the world if you're on a budget, because obviously it's not going to be the best execution thereof. But they made smart decisions, like picking good quality materials, a great rubber strap, you know, there's so many like leathers that can be good and can be bad, but you know, rubber, if you spend the money and you go to the right manufacturer, you're going to get a good rubber strap. Like if you get an FKM rubber strap, it's going to be class. It'll last your lifetime. It'll withstand all kinds of crap. And this strap is just nuts. It's just great. It's the perfect choice. So I got it. I loved it. I wore it for ages and ages and ages. And then I realized one morning that I wasn't a rapper. And that I was actually a 5'7" very white guy.
Well, I mean, you've got the togs just now.
I was going to say, okay. You're going with the whole, going with the whole wife beater thing, you know?
You know, as I say all this, like, you know, it doesn't match my style. I've got like 50 baseball caps behind me. Is that some
nice snapbacks over on the back?
Yeah, over 50 of them. I'm a snapback collector as well.
Okay, cool.
But, I do actually advertise that more than I probably should, because really, like, I'm a tweed kind of guy. I'm not a goldie looking chain kind of guy. Definitely not. Maybe early Eminem.
Yeah, sub Eminem.
A wee bit, yeah, I have to say.
Vanilla Ace in the house.
Oh, don't start with that one now. He's a bit of an in-house legend at Fratello. Our CEO's got his hairstyle down to a T. And
Jesus.
I hope he listens to this. I made a Vanilla Ice reference the other day, and I don't think he got it. I don't think he realizes that his hairstyle is like dropped straight out of a 1980s music vid. So I'm not a rapper, so I wake up and I'm looking at my wrist and I'm thinking, you know what, Rob? You've got skinny little, I call them chicken wrists. And then somebody pointed out to me the other day, it was Chris Horrocks from Red Bar Manchester, I think it was, so shout out to Chris. He pointed out that chickens don't have wrists. And I was like...
They've got ankles.
Chicken ankles don't sound the same thing. But I think you all know what I'm saying when I say my 16.5 centimeter wrists, despite my bulky hobbitish forearms, couldn't really carry off this monstrosity I was wearing. So I've kept it. I still got it. He's got a ruler out.
He's got the millimeter gauge out.
Dave's been using it. Look, he's marked it off. We call it microfiber, Dave's nanotechnology.
Anyway, I stopped wearing it, but I love the watch and the project so much, I'm not going to get rid of it. But that was, yeah, that's the end of it. I love it. I adore
and you know,
it.
One day you might get that rapper deal.
Yeah, you know what, right? I mean, if I put on a bit of weight, a bit more weight, then I think I'll probably go back to it one day. But the crazy thing was, that project failed. Like, they didn't sell them all in a heartbeat, which I anticipated they would. Nobody believed in it, and it's unlikely that the school's going to run the coursework in the same way again, which is a real shame, because honestly it was the best value watch I think I've ever seen ever. Like,
and what year was that?
You know, it must have been, I'm gonna say 2017. I can't be far wrong there, because I definitely remember opening the box in the house that I bought that year, and I'm pretty sure it was 2017. Could have been 2018, but
it was probably just pre indie hype and, you know, kind of small micro brand hype, isn't it? You know, they almost were a year or two too early.
That's a good point. If that had come out during the pandemic, it might have soared.
Absolutely.
Okay, Dave, what watch can you think of then, either one you've had or one you've seen that was, way, this is amazing, to don't care, and then suddenly, can I like that guy again?
Okay, the one I'm going to choose is one I don't think I've ever got to the point of I don't care, but I've definitely kind of gone through cycles of absolutely adore it and don't want to take it off, and kind of had give or take it. And that's my Speedmaster 321.
Because you don't really talk about that. You did talk about it on Monday's episode in a fleeting glance, but tell us about it then.
For so long, I wanted Omega to bring back a 321. I was always, you know, bring back a 321, bring back. And it was like, it will probably never happen. You know, Omega's moved on. They're not a company that look back in any real sense. They maybe takes a few design cues from the past.
Sorry, the Apollo missions? Yeah.
And they don't look back in terms of technologies. Okay, I'll rephrase. Details. Technologies, you know, they're very much about moving, their movement technologies.
Moving the moon.
Moving the moon. They're very much, wow, the moon is cheese. They're very much about kind of moving forward with movement technologies and new materials and better timekeeping, etc. So I always wanted it. And then when eventually there was the rumours did the rounds, they're bringing back a 321, super limited kind of volumes of production, etc. I then was thinking, I really hope they do it in a case that's kind of time honoured and not just bosh it into something. And then when the Platinum one came out, I was a bit underwhelmed and kind of like, okay, predictable. I knew that was going to happen. But then, of course, there was the rumours about the Steel one, and it came. And in many respects, it's my perfect Speedmaster. I love Speedmasters, but I love some of the vintage ones, but I don't do vintage, delicate. You're never quite sure about the provenance, etc., etc. So this was a new, modern 321 in a properly sized case, etc., etc. And when I had to have it, and was very, very lucky and got one very early on and couldn't get it off my wrist. It was just perfect. But then I quickly realised, or not quickly, but then it began to dawn on me that ultimately it is just a Speedmaster. And I know that sounds terrible because there's lots of folk, I'm sure, who would die to have a 321 and are still waiting on them. But, you know, it's not materially that different from many other Speedmasters out there. And it kind of then would lurk in the box for a while. But then occasionally I would pull it back out and suddenly realise that things like the level of finishing on it and the level of detail on it compared to a regular Speedmaster are just infinitely better than a production Speedmaster, which in itself is not a terribly made watch by any stretch of the imagination, but this is a whole nother level higher. This really is a quite an artisanal product made by one of the big volume manufacturers, and that in itself makes it quite special as well. So I definitely go through phases of must wear it all the time, love it, but I don't think, like you said, Rob, I would never get rid of it. It would be one of the very last ones that would have to go if push came to shove. There's many other things I would get rid of first.
Do you know which watch, if you could even choose just one, would be the last to leave your collection? And if it's the one on your wrist, you know, let's pick another one as well for the sake of conversation, but what would it be? Any idea?
I think it would fall between three watches. The one on my wrist, because that's Dreamliner, I think for a day-to-day, you can wear it smart, you can wear it casual, you can do everything with it. It's about as perfect for me as you can get. The 321 Speedy would be a tough one to let go. That would be super tough. And the other one would be my Joker.
Oh, nice. Oh, of course, yeah.
My Chaikin Joker. For no other reason than it's probably the least day-to-day wearable watch from a point of view of it's a bit unusual. It's not formal in any way, but it's possibly the only watch that I've got that every time I wear it and look at it, I just smile. And it genuinely makes me feel happy when I look at it because it's so just stupid and daft. But I know it's got a bit of something under the hood. You know, it's just a cool watch. So between those three, if you had to make me choose between those three, that would change by day, put it like that.
Right. Well, this is where we use the burning house theory, right?
You've
got a watch in each room. You've only got enough oxygen and life ability to get into one of those rooms in the burning house. Which room do you go into? Which watch do you save?
I'd be dead.
Yeah. I'd just bed down in the cellar.
I'd run between the rooms going, that one.
You'd be like, where's my porn collection? Where's my porn collection?
Exactly. If I had to run between three rooms and grab it, the likelihood is I'd run straight out of the house because the most likely possibility is I'd have the Streamliner on my wrist.
Nice answer. Do you sleep with a watch on your wrist?
Nope.
No, me neither. Shower with a watch on the wrist?
Dave doesn't know what that is.
Shower?
Golden shower, Dave. Golden shower.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yes. Crown's done.
It can't be a Speedmaster. Water resistant.
No, okay, yeah. Crown's done uptight. I'll more often than not take a watch off. So definitely don't sleep in it. Baths, showers, things like that, I'll take it off. Even if I'm sitting at the desk typing or using the computer, I'll 9 times out of 10 take my watch off as well. I wear it when I'm out and about, and more often than not, I'll take it off because it annoys me a watch clattering off a desk. Aside from what it might do to damage the watch, it just really annoys me, that kind of clacking noise off the desk.
Yeah, I've ruined many of my bracelets. In fact, every single one of my Speedmaster bracelets has been destroyed by my Mac. I mean, it's metal, for God's sake. Metal on metal. It's really annoying. So I do take them off now. And I've recently been sent a valet tray. Is that what they call them? The little leather trays where you chuck your stuff? Never liked them before. Yeah, I've always avoided them, actually. I've always sort of thought they were a bit unnecessary. But I must admit that they're quite nice to just sort of keep everything neat and tidy on the edge of the desk when I sit down. Because I do, like you, take my watch off a lot of the time when I'm typing on the Mac. But that burning house theory is good. I think I would, I might just sort of like, that might be the one moment in my life where I fail to make a decision in time and collapse in the hallway and perish with my watches or run.
I mean, I'd like to ask Ricky the question, but I know his answer. He's probably got like a go box already prepared, sitting sealed, fireproof, waterproof, sitting just at the edge of the front door so that when he knows eventually what is going to happen and someone tries to burn him out of his house, he just walks out with a rucksack with all his worldly goods and a box full of watches and wanders down the street like some hobo wandering into the new life.
You've read my autobiography then?
Well, I'm writing it for you, haven't I? So we know how it goes.
You're ghostwriting it. As you can probably guess, and people that listen to the show will know, the watch I would keep would be the Batman, because that's the, I need a backstreet operation somewhere and need to get some cash quick, that would be the one to go. Apart from that, let's put that to the side, like you were putting the Streamliner to the side. The next watch that I've got that I wouldn't get rid of, at the moment, probably the red one. and pretty much for the reasons that Rob said early, and that is I wouldn't want to annoy the people that didn't get the opportunity to get one. I wouldn't want to piss Max off either, because I could have bought it, could have flipped it for 18 grand in Chrono 24. That's what they were going for. Day one, week one, month
hey,
one.
Hey, did anyone sell the red one? People actually sold it?
Yeah, there was three went up.
That is really bad form.
And me and Dave have had a chat on the show before about what is the amount of time that you should give between buying a watch that's in demand, where you're going to put someone's nose at a joint because they would really like it, and you've got it and you're going to flip it for big cash. There was no definitive answer, obviously, because we were just speaking hypothetically. But my point was, a year seems like a good idea.
I say two, personally. That's what I always say. And I think I picked up that habit from something I heard from one of the Rolex ADs that I used to work with Nomos. I think that they kind of accept that after a couple of years of ownership, anybody could desire to move on from a watch or buy another one to upgrade from it. And I think it's an arbitrary term of time, but I just stuck with it myself. And I thought 2 years, I'll buy something. If I've not worn it excessively after 2 years, if I haven't formed a connection after 2 years, maybe it goes on the trading or sales block, but not before.
Well, I said a year, you said 2 years, and Dave said, I paid for it, I'll sell it tomorrow.
The only thing I temper that with is, I think if someone's done you a favour, like say Max, for example, with the case of these Mad Ones, or someone's gone out their way to get you something and, you know, that's hard to come by, etc., I think that's where you have to bring in a degree of kind of respect and due deference to that, because someone's gone out their way and done you a favour. And I think that's different. I think if you walk into any shop and pay full whack and your own money and buy something, then timeline should be whatever you feel the timeline should be.
Yeah, that's fair enough. But where does that happen in this day and age? I mean, if we're talking about the watches that go for big bucks on the secondary market, they're exactly the type of watch you can't just walk into a shop and get from. Like, so if you want to go to your Rolex AD and buy a Daytona and then go home and sell it on Chrono for 10 grand over list price, that's cool. But if you can buy a Daytona from that AD, then you must have a relationship with them that probably took you a long time to build up.
Or no gag reflex.
Well, I was going to say, I guess what that relationship looks like, if you've got a true relationship where you're getting things that are hard to come by because you have spent money over time, etc., etc., and you have a genuine relationship, my feeling is most of those customers aren't the type of customers who will just be flipping it for profit. If your relationship's predicated upon you spending lots of money on stuff that you don't need just to get the stuff that you want to be able to make a profit, then that is already a commercial relationship in its own right, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose you're right.
And now might be a good idea for Dave to check if his audio recorder settings have changed since he had a microphone plugged in the last time.
He has, yes.
He has checked that. He has learned from his prior mistakes.
Yeah, it wasn't a mistake. I preempted the mistake.
Shame your parents didn't.
Wow. Just fucking wow. You absolute belly.
You'd have been better sprayed up your mum's curtains. Anyway, I think it's about time we actually go back to basics, because we've been chatting to this fella for a while now. I know the guys have kind of lost their shit here. We've been chatting to Rob for a while, but we don't have his origin story. And he's worked for a whole lot of places. He name dropped Nomos there, Bremont, other places. So hit us with it. 3/4 of the way through the show, you can give us your intro.
I'm not sure I can follow this now with an origin story, unless it is like a graphic birth story. I caused my mum to hemorrhage after I was born, if that's like, you know, relevant. They pulled me out with forceps. I had a triangular shaped head. I was blue. I didn't open my eyes for 3 days, and my hip was out of joint. So they put me in leg braces and told my parents I was blind. And then
this place here.
Yeah, yeah. It still slips out every so often when I'm decorating the curtains, actually, to be honest. Yeah. But yeah, after that traumatic introduction to life, and, you know, a good justification for why my parents always preferred my younger two siblings, I fell in love with watches at about the age of 17. Started working at H. Samuel in Manchester on Market Street, selling like police watches, DKNY stuff, doing battery changes, straps and whatnot, and flogging those god-awful porcelain ornaments that I don't know who buys for whom. And that was when I decided I wanted to sort of be in watchmaking, but that dream faded slightly when I went to university, which was a bit of a mistake. Studied...
What did you do there?
I did archaeological science, but only because I lost a bet to my best mate over a game of foosball, because I couldn't decide what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to be a writer, so I said, I just need to learn about stuff, I guess, so you just can pick my degree for me. And so he beat me at this game of foosball, which, you know, it empowered him to choose my degree, and he chose the first thing alphabetically in the prospectus, which was archaeology. I started off doing the BA, but I switched to the BSc after a year because I found that was a bit more up my street. But I was bored with it anyway. We only had about 4 hours contact time a week. So I ended up getting a full-time job as a clothing designer in Sheffield. And I fell in love with that, like working with my hands. And the idea of watches came back to me. And I thought, you know, maybe now is the time to pursue a trade instead of an academic career, because I didn't really feel it was for me. And I spent the next 5 years, I think, applying for sponsorship to go to training. When I first had the idea, I'm not even sure the British School of Watchmaking was open. I think it was maybe in the works of opening, and then it opened its doors and I got into the 2010 class after, yeah, many years of applications. I even went and worked in a bank in the meantime because I thought that my dream was not going to happen. I got fed up with that, handed in my notice, and I was walking down Market Street and I saw in the window of a Swatch store on Market Street an advert for a sales assistant. So I went in there thinking, if I can get into the Swatch group somehow, maybe I'll be able to get more contacts to increase my chances of getting sponsorship to be a watchmaker. So I just quit my job in custodian banking and I walk into the Swatch store and say, hello, I'd like to work for you. And I'm in a full suit. I've got a briefcase, you know, tie and everything, umbrella under my arm, look like a right knobhead, to be honest. But I think they thought that I was in the wrong place, or if they thought, I think that it said assistant manager on the door. But it was just a sales assistant. They thought I'd made the mistake. They thought I wouldn't take like a, you know, low down position or whatnot. But I was more than happy to take anything I could get at that point to just give myself another chance. So I went home that night and I sort of memorized, you know, the company report from the year before and went in and rattled off all these completely irrelevant statistics to them to impress them with my love for the Swatch group. And they gave me the job. And then I got all of the contact details for everybody in HR in Southampton. And I wrote the same application letter to all of them, printed it off 4 times each and mailed about 100 letters a day to them. Just one day. I didn't do it every day. I'm not like insane. I just thought I'll just do this once, just completely like flood with my name. And if that doesn't get me at least an interview, then, you know, maybe I'll just do something else, go back to banking or I don't know. I didn't hear anything for about 4 months. So I was happily playing my trade at the Swatch store, selling Swatches. And then they called me up and said, I've got an interview and I've got to go in for a manual test and an IQ test. And I did that and I passed and I got in and I was one of the graduates in 2012 from that college. I got sponsorship from Omega. So I went down to Southampton and worked there for 2.5 years at the bench. And then I jumped over to Bremont for just a year, which is when I started writing for a blog to watch at the same time. Caused a bit of a controversy. There was questions of whether or not I would have a conflict of interest working for a brand and writing about all brands, but that was never really an issue. That was just, they were nasty.
Who brought that up?
Well, actually, funnily enough, it was, I don't know exactly, but I know it was one of 6 journalists. I know for a fact it was
name
one.
Name them all.
I am not going to name them all now as a professional courtesy. But one of them tried to, you know, get rid of me before my writing career could begin. I always put it down to the fact he was a bit scared of the fact I was actually a watchmaker. So rather than being born with a silver spoon in my mouth, might come at this with a bit more credibility.
Well, you've narrowed down the pool there, my friend.
Yeah, well, you know, I think you can figure it out. Anyway, that happens. And then out of nowhere, I got a job with Nomos as an account sales manager for the UK.
So what were you doing at Bremont? Were you watchmaking?
Yeah, I was still watchmaking. Bremont. I was still watchmaking. I was one of a very small team of watchmakers servicing, basically.
Right.
So like while I was there, they had Stephen McDonnell, who you probably know best from MBNF, in there trying to figure out the modular movement for Bremont to actually make something in-house. And he was doing the proper watchmaking. I was just doing the dog work. I was just servicing chronographs and, you know, standard 2836s and whatnot. But it was fun. It was a beautiful place to work even then. I've not even been to the new wing yet.
Well, they spoke highly of you when I was down there.
Did they really? Well, that's nice. Time has obviously softened memories. I don't think I was particularly popular while I was there. Not with my bosses. I've never been very popular with any boss I've ever worked for because I'm a cantankerous, anarchic little which is a bit...
Well, that's the thing. See, before we recorded the show with you last week, I thought, this guy's a fucking wank. But then we recorded with you, we like you. It's obviously birds of a feather, eh?
Yeah, I mean, we are quite a lot alike, aren't we? I mean, that's the first thing I thought about you.
We are all cats, yes.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. it works for us in our own little way. But no, it's nice to hear that Bremont and saying nice things about me now, because I actually really enjoyed working for him and treasure that year as well, because it was nice to get another year at a different bench, you know, in a completely different environment and working for a company that was really on the up then. And I think now some of the stuff that they're doing is genuinely, genuinely laudable, especially the ENG 300. I love that movement. I think it's just a gorgeous thing to look at. So
Arash love it too.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I bet they do. But yeah, well, they know what they're doing when it comes to making a nice looking movement. You know that. So So then there was the Nomos thing, and I started off working for Nomos as the UK and nominally Ireland manager, but we didn't actually have any boutiques in Ireland. I was just trying to find some representation there. And that went very well in the first year, and it quickly expanded to the Netherlands and then to all of Scandinavia and Benelux and Eastern Europe, and eventually training the retailers in the States. So at one point I was working in 17 countries, just traveling around, constantly living out of a suitcase, training for Nomos. And that nearly killed me. I certainly lost my sense of self along the way. I was a wraith of a man, as I used to say. There was basically nothing left but a vague whiff of alcohol vapor as I passed by. So eventually I left and went freelance full time for a year, worked for about 7 different media outlets and pursued a couple of little sideline projects. And then Fratello came calling. And I ended up finding my forever home, you know, with some of the best guys in the industry, and a place where I was finally able to just do my own thing. And that's it.
You've touched many different facets of the industry and many facets outside the industry, which gives you a bit of kind of guest life experience as well. All too many just end up in watchmaking school and end up repairing watches for the rest of eternity, which is maybe what they'll love. But, you know, you've got a fair scope of experience within the watch sphere there anyway.
Thanks. I mean, the nicest thing for me about being in the industry is meeting all the people within it, like the like-minded people and, you know, sometimes even the people that aren't anything like you whatsoever, and appreciating those differences and how yet you can still be drawn to the same kind of thing.
There's so many people you meet, aren't there, from very, very different walks of life, different upbringings, different backgrounds, et cetera, et cetera. But there is that kind of commonality there, and they are we are very different people sometimes, but it's amazing how similar we can be.
Well, I noticed that when I went across with you to Dubai last year. First time across, first time obviously at Dubai Watch Week. And I'm just a little scumbag from the east end of Glasgow. Never had any money at all. Still doesn't have any money. But I'm rubbing shoulders with millionaires, billionaires, TV guys, pop stars, the greatest watch designers, creators and inventors on the planet. And the thing that brought us all together was horology. And it worked.
It is mega. I often find myself thinking that, like, I did a little boy that grew up in Glossop, you know, with nothing like a luxury background, end up in this industry. And the luxury aspect of it to me is it's still a little bit alien. And even after all this time, I mean, it's more than half my life, more than half my time on this planet that I've still not quite become accustomed to existing in that. I certainly feel like I'm a little bit of an alien, but I don't...
Imposter syndrome?
No, you know, I don't think...
Not in your career.
No, not in my career.
Circles.
Maybe, I'm not even sure. It's not that I don't feel good enough. It's just that I feel like it's very different to what I would be doing if I weren't in this industry. Like, I enjoy it and I respect it. And I really find myself saying to my colleagues, especially the younger colleagues that haven't been in the industry as long or as extensively, can you believe that we get to do this for a job? Like, look around you, look at like the luxury and like, look at all these beautiful people. Look at the fact people are serving you champagne, or we're on a yacht, or we're on top of a skyscraper, or we're in the Arctic, or we're on a volcano, or whatever the heck it is that you happen to be doing that week. I really try and remind my friends and colleagues like how goddamn lucky we are, because I miss my hometown. I'll probably never go back to live in England. I got a German girlfriend. I'm probably going to stay here for the rest of my life, but I'll always, always rank flying home over the Peak District and landing in Manchester and going to the Working Men's Club in Woolley Bridge is the best thing I could possibly do with my time, always. And if I fell out of the watchmaking industry tomorrow, I'd just probably spend the rest of my time drinking Frank Wood's beer in the Working Men's Club until I'm dead. But I'd be very glad of the fact that I got to appreciate and enjoy all of this stuff right now. And I'd be damned if I let like a moment of it go by without actually consciously appreciating it, because it's mad.
That's the way to be.
You're absolutely right on that. You know, again, many things mirror my life. You know, I didn't come from a poor background, but I didn't come from a moneyed background either. You know, I didn't ever want for anything, but I didn't get shrouded in luxury as I grew up either. You know, like anyone else, I fought with my mother, I want Nikes. You're not getting Nikes. You can have a pair of these because that's what you're getting. Fine, no problem. Never went hungry, never felt unloved, etc. But didn't get whatever I wanted. Didn't get a PlayStation on demand, etc., etc. But, you know, I've been lucky through my working life to be exposed to things that are not, I guess, my normal background. And you have to remind yourself constantly that you are lucky and that that is a unique position that many people never get to even experience, never mind get to do it regularly. And yeah, I'm like you. I've I was away from home for a long time, and I'm really enjoying actually being back home for a while at the moment. It's great.
Very similar. I had a prior life in motor journalism. That was back in the performance car days when the Fast and Furious films had come out. And that was a thing where I would get dragged across to Germany to go tours of factories where cars were made. And we'd go to all the race events, be all these hyper performance cars. And I was just steeped in something new. And then I did it the same with music. Got to DJ with the likes of Armin van Buuren and other folks like that. And at every point, I've always been super grateful and practiced a lot of gratitude, because you don't know how long you've got. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You couldn't have predicted a pandemic. I couldn't have predicted nearly dying in a motorcycle accident nearly 10 years ago. You just don't know. You know, the next page is unwritten. So live for the moment. Enjoy life to the max.
What a message. Wow, when did this happen? Become like a self-help podcast. I feel inspired.
Well, before we finish up, because that has been an extremely quick hour and a fairly easy edit, because you're one of the few guests that we've had on here that has got really good microphone technique. Although you are dripping sweat droplets all over the table, the microphone and the pop filter, if you guys could see the Zoom, I may actually take a screen capture from one of these Zoom videos here. This guy is sweating buckets. It's like a little sauna going on in his office there. But there's no ums, as, you knows. Pretty much you're the anti-Dave on the show here, so the edit's going to be absolutely miraculously easy for me.
You're welcome.
I don't know what you're talking about.
We'll actually get people writing nice comments about this guy instead of saying they enjoy it when you're not on the show, Dave.
I know, it's outrageous.
It is. Did you see that guy apologise to you as well?
Did he?
He did.
In the comments? No, I've not seen it yet.
He's apologised to you.
Oh, what a shame. Thank you for the apology.
He's obviously scared. He thinks you won't use a condom next time and he'll catch you. So it's all good. That is the end of a show. These are the things that get edited out. This is why we don't do this live. Oh, dearie me, dearie me. Sorry, Mizzy, I know you guys have to listen to all this shit. Right, so before we do finish up the show for reals, anything else you'd like to tell listeners you've got coming up? Have you got any trips abroad, any watch brands we should keep an eye on, any articles coming out for Fratello or anywhere else?
Okay, I'll try and be relatively quick. I'm going to the Tour de France next week.
Nice.
Dave will be interested in that. He likes cycling.
I've done it quite a few times. Have you done it before?
I've been as a spectator maybe 20 years ago when David Miller was riding, but I haven't been for a long time. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm going with Tissot. I'm going to ride 50 kilometers off the stage in Lausanne and then hopefully get a chance to interview some of the riders in the winner's enclosure. I'm keeping my fingers crossed for Peter Sagan. He's my favorite.
Are they still taking lots of drugs? Was that
fewer, and they're getting better at it all the time. So, right, you know, okay. But I believe that they're
less
knocking
noticeable.
It on the head.
Less noticeable.
Yeah.
Cycling, bicycles, not steroids. I like it.
Yeah. You know, I grew up as a cycling fan. I actually dreamed of being a professional road cyclist when I was a wee lad. But I have no problem with the drug-fueled era of the past. And I really would be quite happy for the results to stand as they are and just put an asterisk next to it.
I saw a great meme, seen it many times before, and it says, you know what, they should have a section in the Olympics where people can take as many drugs as they want.
Oh, hell yes.
Let's see what humans can do.
Yes, absolutely. I would, you know, I'd love to see that. Well, I mean, it is fascinating to know, isn't it? I mean, it's really dangerous. It'd be like the F1 of athletics, because you just get to tune up like all of the human body with all these new drugs and these new prosthetics and, you know.
Group B Olympics.
I was going to say Group B rallying for humans.
Anyway, I didn't want to get into the drug conversation because that is a whole other podcast that I would gladly return for, because it is a fascinating thing.
Oh, I like foreshadowing.
I'll have an interesting chat about that with you.
All right, good. No, I look forward to that. I'm sure that you have a lot of very well-reasoned opinions.
You'd be quite a good guest for our drunk live YouTube shows.
I do like drinking. And I do it live. That's fine.
Okay.
That's the fourth wheel for that one, I think.
I also have good reason to be in Scotland visiting our good friends at Anodyne at some point in the near future, because one thing we have coming up on Fratello is a very interesting release with them. So keep your eyes peeled for that. It is going to be something quite new. And in August, or maybe early September, once I get back, about a very exciting expedition I'm taking to the island of Jan Mayen to visit the Barenberg volcano with a new Norwegian brand called Straum. Because we are building a whole watch collection inspired by this unique area of Norway's, shall we say, countryside? I'm not sure. I mean, it is countryside, but
mountain ranging,
yeah. Something very special. And we're, again, very lucky, taking a boat from Svalbard and sailing 2 days and two nights to get to this remote island, which is actually closer to Greenland and Iceland than it is to Norway, to do an expedition to the summit of the volcano And then, nice. You know, depending on my mood, I might just jump straight into the eye of it and check out entirely in a blaze of glory.
We have got Rob on the show with us. He is from Fratello plus other places. Do you have a personal Instagram account people can follow?
Yeah, it's just at Rob Nuds. Luckily, no one else has that name.
And that's double D?
Yeah, it is, of course. A single B for all our American friends that like to spell my name R-O-B-B, but it's R-O-B-N-U-D-D-S.
Excellent. And of course, you can follow us at Scottish Watches, our website, scottishwatches.co.uk. Try not send us any DMs on Facebook or Instagram. They just get lost in amongst all the tags and stuff that goes on. So if you want to contact us, please do so, but do so via email, info@scottishwatches.co.uk. So thanks, Rob, for coming on for this second part, which will come out the day after the first part that is on your channel, that if people haven't already heard, they're going to have to go and listen to that now. And you can catch that Fratello on air on all good podcast platforms. So thanks for listening, and we will catch you guys again soon.
Take care.
Bye, guys. Oh.